This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
This is E.O. Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams, and you're listening to the
Humanist Network
Humanist
News.
Network
Humanist
News.
Network News.
The Humanist Network News.
It's September 24th, and you're listening to the Humanist Network News, an audio production by the Institute for Humanist Studies.
And the official podcast of the American Humanist Association.
Podcasting from the Stephen Yule Imagine No Superstition studio.
We got no superstition today. Black cats walking under ladders, umbrellas indoors.
Breaking mirrors. Number 13 all over the place.
We should probably say who we are. I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And we've got media debacles and celebrities on the brain for today's show.
But even more so on the brain, Duncan, is the topic of our show, namely humanism.
Which is a worldview based on reason, compassion, and creativity. Jess and I never write a script either, so forgive us. Okay, anyway, in the second half of the program, we're going to be hearing from the gentlemen of the National Secular Society of the United Kingdom. They're going to be talking about some of their media experiences and dealing with celebrities.
And in the first half of the show, we actually have a celebrity who reminds me, Duncan, an awful lot of you, what with his, how to put this delicately,
cranky disposition,
perhaps, and the bushy brows was another thing that I was thinking
of. I can
of.
Catch flies with these things.
Yes, that's right.
Do I hear a clock ticking?
You do.
Okay, that's a hint, listeners. Can you guess who's coming up next?
Andy Rooney, thank you for speaking with me.
Good to be here.
In 2004, you made some comments at the Tufts graduation about being an atheist and your views on religion, and I wanted to ask you, what has prompted you to be more vocal in your atheism?
Well, I'm not very vocal about it. People don't like it. I mean, I don't think it makes me any more popular to say I'm an atheist. But if the subject comes up, I have to be honest about it, and I am an atheist.
And how do you feel about the degree with which the candidates are speaking about their faith in this election?
Well, I think they do it for the same reason they do everything else, to get votes. They think it's the popular thing to do. And if they said they were atheists, they'd lose a lot of votes.
So I did meet one congressman, Pete Stark from California, who finally acknowledged that he is an atheist. Do you think that more politicians should speak up about being atheists, or do you think they should just refuse to speak about their religion at all?
Well, I certainly think if they are atheists, they should say so. I mean, there has been, religion has gotten along amazingly well on very little, and people do not inspect their faith much as logically as they would other things in their lives.
Andy Rooney, thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Boy, Duncan, they'll let anyone into those press conferences now, won't they?
That's what I should have asked him at the end of the interview. Like, did you ever notice how they'll let anybody into these things? I caught up with Andy Rooney at the Albany Academy on Friday. He was giving a talk to the students there about his lifetime career in journalism. And for those of you who don't know who he is, he's famously known for being the curmudgeonly commentator who appears at the end of the CBS news broadcast, 60 Minutes.
Right.
He's also a syndicated columnist. It's mostly humorous stuff. You know, like, did you ever notice this? And why is it, you know, this?
Cotton balls and medicine containers.
Cotton balls and medicine. Yeah, he has one where he's just looking at things on his desk, like elastic bands. Awesome. Why do they call scissors a pair? So anyway, I am a graduate of the Albany Academy, 1996, and Andy Rooney is a graduate of the class of 1938.
But that's not all.
Andy Rooney's won 3 Emmys,
yep.
But I won the Andy Rooney Literary Prize as a senior in high school.
Nice.
And I actually, that's kind of how I weaseled in to chat with him. And I sort of started off by telling him I was a recipient. And he says, I ought to get a list of all the people who've won that award so I can see what you're doing with your lives.
Whoops.
So I better do something
with
my life.
Let's go, Duncan.
I did get a chance to give him a copy of the H&N Highlights CD.
Ooh.
That we created, so.
I wonder, huh?
I wonder. I have a feeling he might have listened to it, but I don't know how far he got into it.
Could be some Deers coaster off of the
87
South.
So he is a humor writer and a humor commentator, but he does get into hot water every once in a while, talks about some controversial topics. And, you know, the atheism angle, he has mentioned it before, as he said. I should clarify also, I said in the interview, you know, a Tufts graduation speech. It wasn't a graduation speech. It was actually just a talk he gave at Tufts. But yeah, anyway, he has said he's an atheist a couple times. It's not like a big issue.
Right.
But if anyone out there is listening and you want to go to his Wikipedia page, it still says he's rumored to be an atheist. So,
and they could link to your interview with him.
You could link to this audio file and we'd get more listeners.
Nice.
All right. So moving on.
Yep.
We still have the media and celebrities on our brain. The next segment we're going to play is something I recorded at the IHEU World Congress this summer. I was doing a total flagrant knockoff of NPR's popular program StoryCorps.
That's right.
So this is unofficially known as Humanist StoryCorps. And what it is I just have two humanists talking to each other. I don't interview them. I let them chat with each other. And
nice.
We get to sort of eavesdrop.
Yeah.
Shall we say who we are?
Yeah.
My name's Terry Sanderson. I'm the president of the National Secular Society in London.
And this is Keith Porteous Wood, the executive director of the National Secular Society.
Yes, and being the sort of leading secular activists in Britain does get you to some very strange places. And one of the strange things that we have to do is sort of be all-purpose kind of experts on everything, and occasionally we overestimate our abilities in that respect. And I remember one particular occasion when we were invited, well, I was invited to go on radio on the BBC, one of their national channels, and talk about stem cell research. And because the religious lobby was opposing it, I was sort of brought in to defend it. And I said, oh, yes, great, you know, I'll do that. And when I put the phone down, I thought, bloody hell, I don't know anything about this. I don't know the first thing about stem cell research. And the religious lobby had probably got some real big expert on it, you know, a proper scientist. And so I was Googling till about 3 a.m. to go on the 5 o'clock news, trying to become an expert, an instant expert in embryology in 2 hours. Anyway, I went on thinking, you know, I'm going to get slaughtered now. I'm going to get totally humiliated. And they had this little Muslim chap opposite me who had even less knowledge of science than I had. And I felt quite, you know, as though I was Richard Dawkins or something. You know, I knew everything about stem cell research, and I could use these sort of big words about it that I'd seen on the internet. And this old chap, this little Muslim chap, hunched up on the other side of the studio, didn't know the first thing about it. And I turned out to be, you know, a really big expert on it. So that just goes to show that you can be an expert in any field that you want to, in a matter of moments, really, now that we've got Google. So that was my awful experience, and I lost a lot of sleep over that for no reason.
Oh, well, mine was a less happy experience, in a sense, in that I thought I was quite prepared for this technical legal discussion. And I was on the most serious breakfast time radio program, the really top news program that all the politicians listen to, and the then have the Prime Minister on there and leading politicians, and I was on with some really quite heavyweight people, and they asked me this really complicated question. And the microphones in this studio are like the tops of rifles. They actually come out of the table and are pointing slightly towards you. And I remember thinking just very briefly, my goodness, I wish that was a rifle and somebody pushed the flaming trigger, because I've just, here I am with I don't know how many million people listening, and I don't have the foggiest idea of what the answer to this question is. And my goodness, I don't want to admit it. But, so I kind of waffled my way out of it, but I didn't feel very
good. Well, we don't get invited onto that program very often for some reason. But I remember that morning that I went on, that Saturday morning, we'd spent a huge amount of lobbying trying to get on this politics program. The BBC's Religious Affairs Department are given a two and a half minute slot every day to give what they call thought for the day, but it's restricted entirely to religious believers, and we've been lobbying to get some secular humanist people on to give our sort of thought for the day, because it's a 2.5 minute unchallenged slot, and every other item on that two-hour program is debate, and the interviewers are very tough. They really give it to you bad. And I was on for something or other, and I was sitting there in the studio waiting my turn, and then they had thought for the day, and this woman came in with her little script, and she sat next to me at another microphone, and she started reading this religious drivel. I mean, it really was drivelly stuff about, you know, she'd managed to work it around to a country house detective thing. And I thought, what the hell is this woman talking about? And I thought, this is the slot that we really want. And we almost took the BBC to court over it. And I thought, this is my opportunity. I could snatch that microphone right out of her hand and do a really big, you know, sort of agitprop type thing and start yelling down the microphone about the injustice of it all. I thought we'd never get invited into the BBC again. They'd never let us pass security if I did that. So unfortunately, I didn't, but I really, really wanted to.
Yes, Terry earlier referred to us taking the BBC to court over this. It's actually quite a serious issue. We got a petition together with 100 really top people, like sort of the first 30 pages of Who's Who, all saying that it was absolutely outrageous that the only group that couldn't speak were people who weren't religious, apparently not capable of a thought that was worthy, and that it was total discrimination, and they ought to give us an opportunity. After this letter was addressed to the governors of the BBC, and it spoke volumes that the manager from the department that ran this slot actually came on the main part of the programme, the news programme, the next day and said no, that our request had been rejected. Now, how was it that we wrote to the director general and the governors, and they'd all managed to scrabble round in the overnight to answer that question? And the answer was very clearly they hadn't, and that this woman had felt she had the authority to answer for them. I thought spoke volumes. It actually shows just how the religion goes through the BBC. The names through candy or rock at the seaside. So we did actually continue after that to make a very formal complaint, a much more detailed one, to the directors and the Board of Governors of the BBC. And similarly, there was a response it was in the middle of the summer, and the response came suspiciously quickly. At a time we found out when all the board meetings were, and we knew, even though the denial came back that Director General's rejection of our complaint, when we knew there hadn't been a board meeting. So we got one of our honorary associates, a very prominent journalist called Polly Toynbee, to actually phone up the top people in the BBC and quiz them about this and exactly what was the date of the meeting and all this kind of thing. And, of course, they came up with the best excuse imaginable. Oh, well, your complaint just missed the post, you know. But they didn't quite explain why, despite it having missed the post to the governors, that they still managed to reject it. So we did take them to court. And we got a fair way. But, unfortunately, we discovered that we were up against a case that had been a precedent where a right-wing extremist in Austria had taken the Austrian Broadcasting Corporation to court. And the decision had been that provided balance had been shown throughout the totality of the broadcasting company's output, that he couldn't insist on balance in one particular slot. So we would just have been pouring good money after bad if we'd pursued it. So we withdrew.
Yeah, but the other thing about being the sort of president of the National Secular Society, and I have to be elected every year so I could get booted out next month. But the nice thing is that you meet all kinds of people that you would never come into contact with in any other circumstances. And Keith does the lobbying. He goes into Parliament and he meets all these high-up politicians and so on. And I do the communications. And I meet all kinds of people like Philip Pullman and Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, who are all honorary associates of ours. And we decided when we won our case on blasphemy, when we managed to get Parliament to abolish blasphemy once and for all, one of our 140-year ambitions, and there it was, gone. And we decided to hold a big party for it, which will be on the 21st of June. So we started thinking about how we would structure this and who we would invite. And the last case of blasphemy in Britain, which was brought successfully, was a poem in a gay magazine called Gay News. And it was about a Roman centurion who fantasized about having sex with Jesus. And it had been taken to court and successfully prosecuted. So we thought, who would be the best person to read this poem? And we thought about Sir Ian McKellen, the famous actor. And I thought, he will never come, never in a million years. But I had met him in other circumstances, and I had his address. So I wrote to him, and he wrote back and said, "Oh yes, that would be very good, my dear boy. We should love to do it, and we should be there for your part." And you know, so we now got the world's leading Shakespearean actor coming along to read this really quite dirty poem. I mean, it's not very dignified for him, but he seems to be quite happy to do it. It's a symbolic thing, isn't it? You know, it's sort of really quite symbolic, but we're really looking forward to that. It's going to be quite a party.
The whole issue about the blasphemy law has been a fascinating campaign for us. It was kicked off by one of our honorary associates who spotted an opportunity to make an amendment to in a particular law that was going through Parliament. And we initially didn't think that it stood much chance. I remember I worked through Christmas with all the background to the amendment and making sure that this Member of Parliament had all the reference and information that he needed, and expecting that it would never come to anything. But in fact, he managed to get an incredible degree of support from his parliamentary colleagues, to the point that the government realised that there was a significant risk that he might actually succeed in his amendment. And it says something about our parliamentary system, that they were really worried about that, because having an established church, it would have pushed the government into the rather embarrassing situation of having to accept this amendment that was really taking away something from the established church, even though it didn't want it or hadn't been consulted upon it. So suddenly the temperature changed, and I was sitting next to the MP, and he got a telephone call from a government minister saying, "Hey, can we do business?" And what the government did was to say, "We will take over the amendments. If you withdraw it, we will take it over, and we will give it government support so it gets through. But we will consult the church first." So we were interested. But we wanted to make sure that we had a cast iron guarantee. And when the day of the debate came, there were negotiations going on the floor of the House. I was watching them with great fascination. Till about 10 seconds before my MP spoke. And what he was doing was making sure that the guarantee that was offered was on the record and was watertight. And so by the time he spoke, the government said it will be a short, sharp consultation with the church, which I think was the coded way of saying, well, we have to ask them, but we're going to tell them there's no way, if they say no, that we're going to take any answers, any alternative. We're not going to negotiate with them in reality. So they promised to produce this amendment later in the debate, in fact, in the House of Lords. And when the early days came for the amendment to come down, it didn't appear. So another of our supporters, Lord Avebury, who's been trying to get rid of this blasphemy law for years, put down his own amendment, and that really threw down the gauntlet to the government. And so it was only a matter of a day or so before I was there with him and a government minister negotiating which of the amendments was to go through, ours or theirs, and which one was technically correct. It was a very exciting moment. So when the debate came, we were successful, and that was good. But what was a little depressing was the degree of opposition, not only from conservative equals Republican politicians, and of course in the upper house, that the average age of the parliamentarians is older and they tend to be more religious. But even the government felt that it had to kowtow to the church and say, oh, we don't think that this, we really want to put on record that we don't think that this is any indication of the secularization of the country, which of course it is. But the church was determined to have this idea dissuaded at every turn. It didn't really want to look the reality in the face. So if it wasn't going to get its way, it really wanted the government to pretend that religiosity was still at the level of it was 50 or 100 years ago, when in fact church attendance has been in decline for seven decades now, to the point that only one in 14 people are in church on an average Sunday. So it was a little depressing in that sense, but we got what we wanted, and there's been great jubilation since, and we're very lucky for blasphemy to have gone out on our watch. And I suppose perhaps Terry might, of all people, be the person who will be happiest about that, because some of his predecessors as president of the National Secular Society have actually been to prison for blasphemy.
Yeah, with hard labour, I have to say. I wouldn't like that at all. But the thing about the church and blasphemy is that they were in a funny position anyway, because they've been complaining continuously about the use of blasphemy law in Pakistan against Christians there. And there was also the case of the woman and the teddy bear in Sudan, the English woman who was teaching in the Sudan, who allowed her pupils to call a teddy bear Muhammad. And she was arrested for blasphemy, and it was only through very careful diplomacy that she was released. But, you know, the church would find it very difficult to argue against that in other countries when they had it in available to them in Britain. So I think that may also have played a part in why they didn't resist too hard against the abolition.
That was Keith Porteous Wood and Terry Sanderson of the National Secular Society.
And you can learn more about the National Secular Society at their website, secularism.org.uk. So, Duncan, part of what they talked about was being in uncomfortable situations on national TV and not knowing, you know, not being prepared. I was just curious, you know, as
I can tell where this is going,
director of communications, you know, our PR guy.
Yeah.
If you've ever been in a situation like that.
Well, I'm no stranger to talking about things that I have no business, you know, talking about. So, I know I haven't gotten into any situations quite like that, but I do remember the first time USA Today called here. They've actually called twice. And the first time the reporter says, you know, this is so-and-so from USA Today. Can I speak with Duncan Crary? And I said, like, yeah, just hold on 1 minute and I'll get him. Put it on hold. And I'm like, oh,
nice.
Man.
So you actually answered the phone, but you pretended to be your secretary?
Yes.
Nice.
Yeah. And then I answered it. I picked it up with the exact same voice. But the funny thing is, it was about, she was writing an article about holiday lighting.
Really?
And how all the different faiths use lights in their decorations.
Yep.
So I provided the atheist perspective on holiday.
Interesting.
Holiday lighting. I have no business talking about holiday lighting.
As neither an interior decorator,
yeah.
Nor.
No.
What'd you tell her?
I don't know. I can't remember. It's like, yeah, we like lights.
We really like the way that the light reflects off of the snow. Yeah. That's our favorite.
Yeah. So anyway, then my father took the article around at all these parties. I'm like, this is my son, the famous atheist. Like, that's a great conversation starter. Thanks. You know. And then he leaves.
At Christmas.
Yeah. And you know, they're grilling me about atheism and holiday decorations, yeah, which I'm not qualified to talk about. Nice. So that's all I got.
All right. Now, they also mentioned that Ian McKellen was going to read that poem. Did that actually happen?
Yes, he did. I checked their website. He did it in June.
Nice.
And he read the poem, which is titled, The Love That Dares to Speak Its Name. I don't know if they have a recording of that, but that would be hilarious.
That would
if they
be
did.
Hilarious. Yeah. We should ask them for that.
We actually syndicate. They put out a great e-zine called the NSS Newsline. And we actually syndicate articles from that e-zine in our Humanist Network News e-zine, which we put out during the weeks we're not podcasting.
Nice.
And you can check out our zine at humanistnetworknews.org.
You can download or read transcripts from previous podcast episodes at humaniststudies.org/podcast.
Or at americanhumanist.org/podcast, because the Humanist Network News is the official podcast of the American Humanist Association.
That's right. And we are podcasting from the Stephen Yule Imagine No Superstition studio. You can learn more about Stephen Yule at imaginenosuperstition.com.
And Jess, we love to hear from our listeners. So
yes,
can you give them that toll-free listener comment line?
Sure, Duncan. It's 877-659-1515. And folks, Duncan here has been resting on the laurels of his Andy Rooney Literary Award. I think it's time that he earned a new award, don't you think? And you have the opportunity to help us, to help him.
Nominations are now being accepted for the annual podcast awards.
Yep.
And if you would like to, you could nominate the Humanist Network News, probably in the religion category. It only takes a minute, so to do that, visit podcastawards.com. Well, that's it for today. I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
Thanks for listening.
Humanist Network News is an audio production of the Institute for Humanist Studies, a nonprofit think tank that promotes the philosophy of humanism. Learn more at humaniststudies.org.